The Murthy law firm has been clarifying US immigration laws and procedures for foreign nationals since 1994. We are happy to offer this free service. Please listen to copyright information and restrictions at the end of this recording.
Good afternoon. I am Sheila Murthy, President and CEO of the Murthy Law Firm. Thank you so much for joining us today for a discussion between my colleagues and myself at the Murthy Law Firm to discuss the USCIS and FDNS site visits and investigations, a topic that is unfortunately become a hot topic and something we should expect more of. Joining me today are two of my very brilliant, smart, experienced, and knowledgeable colleagues at the Murthy Law Firm, attorney Aaron Finkelstein, who has been with the law firm over 25 years, been doing U.S. immigration law for about 30 years, Chris Drynan, almost sort of catching up pretty close, I think at like 20 or 25 years, or maybe more, maybe around 25 years at this point. Very knowledgeable. They've been involved with FDNS site visits. They mentor clients. They guide. They speak. So we really can have a lively, good discussion, share war stories with you, et cetera. So what we're going to try to discuss today, of course, is the latest trends and practical tips for when and if the government comes over to your company, knocks on the door of your employees, and you are just not sure what to do, right? This is based on the discussion of the January 17, 2025, the H-1B modernization program that has become effective, because under the new rules, the refusal by an employer to comply with the site visits could actually result in a quicker denial or revocation of the H-1B or the L-1 or whatever petition, but generally it's H-1B petitions. So the law, the new regulation, which is, I guess, got the force of law until there's challenged in a court of law, is to, within quotes, fully cooperate. While I don't like that word in general, because that means we bare our souls to the government, this is really meant to comply with certain very strict conditions laid out by the government when a site visit occurs. So many of you may already be aware of this, or some of you may wonder, okay, which agency should I be expecting as an employer? Which federal agency can knock on my door or my company's door or my employee's door? First, of course, is FDNS, which is the Fraud Detection and National Security, which is a part of the USCIS, which was actually originally formed, if I recall, I don't know, I think maybe they're saying FDNS was in 2004. I know the Homeland Security Act and the division of the agencies was under the Homeland Security Act in 2003. Then you have the ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and of course, the U.S. Department of Labor. And the DOL or Department of Labor is generally involved with I-9 investigations, notice of inspection, which is delivered by certified mail. The DOL will normally serve their notices by mail. The FDNS, on the other hand, tends to conduct phone interviews. They will sometimes send email verification to the employer or the end client. And they also do in-person visits, primarily through contractors, but they could be employees at the work location that is mentioned on the H-1 petition as the work location for the employee or the employer's head office. And that's becoming more and more common. And we expect this trend to continue, especially under the current new Trump administration. Now, the one final point I'm going to make before handing it over to Aaron to have a discussion on a whole bunch of other exciting issues is if your employees are working from home and they relocate or move to another location, the employer is generally required to file an H-1B amendment, the LCA and an amendment, if the new home or the new work location is not within the same MSA or commuting distance of the original work location mentioned on the LCA and H-1 petition, right? On the other hand, if the location, even if it's covered under the LCA, the employer is still required to update the public access file with evidence of notice of posting at the new work location, which I know most employers tend not to do. So from there, let's jump to Aaron talking about the kinds of compliance review and investigations that an H-1B or an L-1 employer could be subject to. Aaron, take it away.
Okay, thank you, Sheila. Well, the H-1 and L-1 employers tend to be under the FDNS, the Fraud Detection and National Security auspices. Among the things that FDNS is responsible for is verifying that companies are being compliant with non-immigrant cases, especially H-1Bs. Now, when you talk about compliance, there's a number of different types of assessments or reviews that they could perform. The first thing they could do is just a general performance of fraud assessment. So to that, what they're looking to do is to see in the overall part of the program the types of fraud that's out there, the extent of the fraud that exists within a particular government program. The second type is compliance reviews. So they can do systematic reviews of certain types of cases that they designate to ensure that there's integrity in the system and the process. So they're reviewing them to make sure, are they elements of the case being met in the assessments when the officers are making decisions and so on and so forth. And finally, they can also do targeted site visits. These targeted site visits are the ones that we focus on primarily for our clients, because when they come, they're inquiring about cases to determine whether there was fraud that was created, whether fraud happened on behalf of the company or by the individual, the employee. So those tend to be the three biggest focus areas for the FDNS.
Great, thank you, Aaron. Before we jump to the common issues that we see with site visits that maybe Chris can address in a minute or two, are there kinds of different examples or different situations that we could discuss to explain? Because sometimes I think as businesses, as tech companies, as employers, it's hard for people to kind of understand when is it a performance fraud assessment versus a compliance review versus an attack or targeted site visit.
Sure. So, I mean, I'll jump in just with one or two examples, and then Chris is welcome to throw some examples in there also. But we had an occasion where a person was a software engineer, and he was listed as a software engineer on the LCA, on the H-1B. Everything was as a software engineer. And when they walked in, they said, hey, we're here, we're doing a site visit, we want to assess, you know, that people are in compliance with their H-1B. They said, no problem, let me get the manager of the office. And the manager of the office walked out, and that was the individual that was on the H-1B as a software engineer. So that was a clear example of where the person was supposed to be one thing and he was something else. He introduced himself that way, and that was a clear example of where they were doing a targeted site visit to inquire to make sure people were in compliance with what they were supposed to be, and the person was not in compliance. Another example might be where they show up to the work site, where they ask to speak to the individual, and it turns out that the individual is not working at that work site. The individual works from home or works from a different work site, and they never updated the public access file. Or the person is supposed to be in that MSA, and it turns out that the person went to a different MSA, completely different city or state, and never did an amendment for an H-1B. Those would be two compliance issues that could potentially show up that would be potentially something that would happen where FDNS would identify fraud or misrepresentation or a problem at a particular location, depending on how prevalent it is. You could also have compliance review issues or performance fraud issues, which the easiest example is multiple filings by one company for the same job opportunity when you're dealing with the cap or lottery cases. So that could be something that could be looked at as a fraud assessment to say one guy, five different applications or five different petitions in the lottery from companies that were all acting in concert, that were all focusing as a group of companies all working towards the same job opportunity. So Sheila, those are two examples that I can give you, which is a large fraud assessment versus an individual assessment that comes, for example, with a site visit. Chris, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Well, we do see these sort of scenarios quite frequently. Another thing that comes up in conversations or in cases is where an employee is moved to a different location without the filing of an amendment. That's another thing that's questioned a lot and is a frequent issue. And that's not, I mean, that's the sort of thing that can happen quite innocently just because of some miscommunication between the employer and the employee. The employee told the employer they were moving. The employer said, okay, yes, we'll take care of that. And it just got forgotten. And that's a common issue that we do see come up in regard to site visits.
Great. Let's jump to the common issues that we're seeing that are happening with site visits, Chris.
Well, the most, as a rule, what the officers are looking for here is to make sure that the employee, whether they be an H1 or L1, is actually doing the work as described in the petition. Any petition is going to have a list of job duties. It's going to say where the person is supposed to be working, sometimes who the client is. But mainly they're going to be verifying that the person is actually doing what they're supposed to be doing. So if you see these emails from FDNS officers, first things they'll ask typically is, what's your job title? What are your duties? Who's your client? How long have you been in this location? How much you paid? They want to see the basics. And you can, whether this be a compliance review or a targeted site visit, they're going to start off with those questions. Is the person actually doing what they're supposed to be doing? Something we've seen recently is FDNS actually asking end clients about the minimum requirements for the job to make sure that it matches what is the minimum requirement in the H-1B petition. So as anyone who does H-1B petitions, when you file an H-1B, you have to get an LCA approved. You have to determine the prevailing wage, and that's going to have a wage level. And that's based on primarily the educational requirements for the job coupled with the experience requirements for the job. So let's say we have an H-1B petitioner, they file an H-1B, and they request a level 2 wage, which would normally, for most jobs, mean that the job requires a bachelor's plus 3 years of experience or a master's plus 2 years of experience. Now, let's say they talk to the end client says, no, this requires a master's and 10 years of experience. Now, the officer is going to report back to USCIS that basically the end client said that the requirements for this job were radically different from what the H-1B said. And that's a problem. I mean, there are legal issues as to whether USCIS can actually make that determination. That's a little bit beyond the purview of what we're talking about today. But we've seen revocations, we've seen notices of intent to revoke with this exact situation where you had a level 1 or a level 2 wage, and the end client came back and said, no, this requires 10 or 12 years of experience. So that's a common issue, seems to be something they're looking at right now. Now, when do these visits occur? Generally, these visits occur after the approval of petition and not before it's decided, although FDNS can conduct reviews for H-1Bs while they're pending, even after a request for evidence is responded to. So most of the visits happen after the petition is approved, after the person has already been working in this role for some time. But basically, FDNS can conduct the visit at any time. Before the petition's decided, after there's been a request for evidence, they have wide latitude on when this all can happen.
Thank you, Chris. Yeah, it's, I think, going to be a real problem because I think a lot of times the end clients, they just think, oh, we really picked this particular individual or candidate because we saw that his resume or her resume had 10 years or 15 years of experience. So, and that's perfect. That's what we need. Even though that ultimately the actual H-1B employer that hired the individual may have only required the level 2 person with a BS or 3 years to perform the job. Is this helpful? It's, ideal for us, but is it mandatory? Is it the minimum required? It's almost like they want us to dance to two different tunes. On the one hand, the DOL for the green card says the minimally acceptable standard, and suddenly here it's the highest possible standard that your client wants, and it's not right. Now, the other thing that concerns me, of course, here is the FDNS conducting, pre-adjudication site, post-adjudication, post-approval, more common being the post-approval. And I know that we've been talking both at the Murthy Law Firm and generally in the legal community about challenging the very existence of the FDNS. And I understand there may be a potential lawsuit that's brewing in challenging the suing the U.S., possibly the Department of Homeland Security or FDNS. because under the Homeland Security Act, which was created back in 2003, the USCIS's main and only focus is supposed to be service, serving the client, the employers and employees, not filing lawsuits, not doing the enforcement. That's what ICE was supposed to do, and CBP was supposed to do that at the border, not USCIS. And somehow, like a Trojan horse, coming in under the guise of the FDNS, the USCIS has now started enforcing these the entire petition, which is absolutely a violation of the law as it was referred to and as it was created more than 20 years ago. And I am surprised that we waited so many years, a couple of decades, to challenge them. But I think it's high time that we joined together and did it and helped. And so, you know, if you read the actual comments to the new H-1B regulations, which became effective from January of 2025, the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, said that the noncompliance rate was found to be much higher for workers that were placed at an offsite or third-party location compared to workers placed at onsite with the employer or the petitioner. So we expect that this would translate, unfortunately, for all those third-party consulting companies, people who are doing this sort of, you know, employer-employee model of having their employees work at other sites, we expect that it is highly likely that a larger percentage of FDNS resources, if they're not challenging, if they don't shut down or reallocate their resources, could very well be focused on H-1B employers or petitioners who are sponsoring workers who are working at third-party client locations. So that's obviously something we need to be prepared for. And so from an employer point of view now, Aaron, I know Muthi Law Firm represents a lot of companies that do this kind of work. We obviously know that they're doing very valuable and good work and service for the country, for larger companies, for a lot of government, federal, state, local governments that are using these kind of H-1B workers because there's a shortage of high-tech workers. What is the best way for the employer, for the H-1B company, the employer, the petitioner, to handle any such site visits or follow-up verifications, et cetera?
Sure. Well, thank you, Sheila. You know, the thing is, before I jump into this, I just wanted to point out something that's a little bit ridiculous. If you think about it, if the site visit comes and then they go to the end client and they ask, what are your minimum requirements? And the end client says 10 years, but then they say, but how is this consultant doing? Oh, he's fantastic. He's doing a fabulous job. He's doing unbelievable. He's really getting our work done. Well, the guy only has a master's in 2 years. So the reality of the situation is that when you're going out and you're using consultants, they don't really focus, the end clients don't focus as much on what the education and experience is because the end client focuses on results. And if the person's not performing well, they simply say, give me another consultant. I can't have this guy. So they're relying on people that don't vet people to determine what the minimum requirements are. So I think it's going to be a strange place, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's going to be a hotbed for lawsuits coming down the road. Sheila, to answer your question, this to me is the meat and potatoes, the big thing of what's changed right now. Because previously in our practice, when we'd have an FDNS investigation, it said you'd have to cooperate. So we'd say, cooperate, what exactly do you want? And they would say, we want to focus on, you know, this particular person, and here's 15 questions we have. And we would say, well, 12 of those 15 questions are outside of the purview of what would give you an answer to be helpful. How about if we answer these 3 questions or these 2 questions? Or they say, we want to come tomorrow. And we say, that's fine. We're not going to be prepared tomorrow. Why don't you come a week from next Tuesday? And we basically put them in a place where it gives the lawyer and the employer an opportunity to put their documents, their information, everything together, and to be able to present it in a way that's most helpful to the FDNS, to the officers, and most helpful to the employer so that if there are issues, they can be resolved and things can move on. Now what they've done is they've changed that. And the way that they've changed that is they've indicated we want the employer to fully cooperate. And if you don't fully cooperate, That means that USCIS can say in their subjective determination, hey, we feel this is not fully cooperative, so we're going to revoke or deny the H-1B or the L-1 petition simply because you refuse to comply with a site visit or refuse to comply with a question. So what is fully cooperate? Well, under the new regulation, it appears to mean that entities will comply with the scope of the reviews, including granting access to the premises, to include the employer's place of business and any site where the work is to be performed, making a representative of the petitioner or the employer available for questions, submitting or allowing review of all pertinent documents that they determine is pertinent, providing access to the workers and allowing interviews with such employees to take place in the absence of the employer or the employer's representative there, and even at a location that's mutually agreed by the employee and the USCIS officer, which many times can be off the employer's site's property or off the employer's site. So this means a completely different type of situation where the officer can go one-on-one with an employee in my opinion, a much more intimidating environment.
Aaron, what about the issue where they're saying that we are required as an employer to provide access to the workers and allow the interviews with such employees to take place in the absence of the employer or the employer's representative or attorney? But wouldn't that violate the attorney-client privileges or the rights of an employer, an employee, to be represented by counsel, which would violate fundamental due process?
Well, I think this is saying the employer's representative is not allowed to be there. It doesn't say if an employee would turn around and say, I feel uncomfortable with you, I want to bring my own lawyer to the situation. But there's really three parties here. There's the government, there's the employee, and the employer. So normally speaking, an employer had the right to be present, an employer could take copious notes, an employer can help to set the time, an employer can help to provide the documents that were necessary. Here is the term fully cooperate, meaning if you delay, if you don't provide immediately, if you don't give us everything, even on a fishing expedition, we could just simply deny your petitions. That takes it to a whole new level of complexity because you have people that are performing jobs that are critical, that they're earning money for the company or providing a resource for the company, and now those people could be gone in a day, could be gone in the time that it takes for the FDNS to actually go through and do the revocation. Now, the truth be told, I've never seen FDNS move that quick that they revoke something in a day, but in theory, it's something that they could possibly do if they felt that there was noncompliance here. But see, those comments in the new rule, they go on to talk about what a refusal to comply could include situations where one or more USCIS officers arrive at the petitioner's work site, they make contact with the petitioner or the employer, they identify themselves to the petitioner's representative, and the petitioner or the employer refused to speak to the officer or the officer refused entry onto the premises to review the human resource records pertaining to the beneficiary right away. Like right away. And just because they said, well, we can't do it right now. We want to cooperate, but right now we don't have a guy to meet with you. We don't have somebody to go over the documents with you. Well, that's refusal to comply. And they're saying
so the documents must be all kept together and ready to be at a knock of a button, at the first knock on the door. The employer is required to have their ducks in a row.
I think the next phase of compliance is going to be being pre-prepared. I think that old saying from Ben Franklin, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. I think it's an ounce of prevention is now going to be worth 50 pounds cure. Because once it opens the door to non-compliance, you just don't know where that slippery slope will take you. I think that there is an area that most employers say, if it comes up, we'll deal with it, we'll fix it in real time. I think you're not going to have that real time flex as much as you did before. I think what you're going to need to do is be super prepared, super organized in documentation, perform internal audits, make corrections that you need to do everything well before anybody comes knocking at the door, is my personal opinion, is the way that this practice is going to shift to.
Okay, so from an employer's point of view, what if they need to get more time? If they need a little more time, how could they possibly kind of ask for more time when and if the officer shows up in person, Chris?
Well, it's unclear with these new regulations how effective that's going to be. I mean, my advice has always been, if FDNS shows up at your office, tell them you want to get a lawyer. Tell them you want to speak to them with your counsel, and you need time to accomplish that. And that's never been an issue. Now, with these new regulations, is that going to be considered failure to cooperate? I don't know the answer to that. I think you can still potentially say, could you give us a day so I can call my lawyer, or can you give us a day to assemble the records? Are they going to be agreeable to that? It might depend on the individual officer. I'm not sure what the response is from FDNS officers is going to be. I've done these investigations quite recently, and they've still been amenable to giving a few days to respond. It's not thus far been an issue, but is it going to be an issue in a month or 3 months when these regulations sort of filter down to the rank and file officers? That's an unknown. I don't know that the old advice is really going to hold true anymore. If you say I want time to get my lawyer on the phone, or I want time to speak to my lawyer, I can see an officer saying that's a failure to cooperate, and that's, I think, a risk. So unfortunately, going forward, I think you really do, as Aaron said, you have to be prepared for this before it happens. You should have a point of contact at the company's headquarters, or at the employees' work locations, who know who FDNS is and know what to do if an officer shows up. So maybe you have a designated point of contact in the office, like an HR manager or in-house attorney, or someone who is knowledgeable and can speak on behalf of the company. And that's important, because you don't want to have someone who has no idea who FDNS is, who does not know why they're there, who doesn't know what they're looking for, talking to them. That's a recipe for disaster. And I've seen situations where people started talking to FDNS and they said stuff that was not true, but was damaging and was difficult to sort of unwind later on, because it was said and it's in the FDNS officer's mind now. So how do you unring that bell? So you want to be careful about what they hear when they first walk into an office or a workplace. And employees also should be aware that these visits are possible. They might show up if they're working at a client, they might show up at the client. If they're working at their home, they might show up at their home. So they should have some plans in place, such as contacting the employer before answering the questions, or at least, even if the officer will not permit that, make sure that the employee understands what the officers are looking for, what they're trying to verify, i.e. the work location, the duties, the salary, perhaps the job requirements. You don't want to have a situation where the FDNS officer is talking to an employee and they have no idea who they are or why they're there. Because that's again, a recipe for disaster. And whatever they say to the officer, it's very, very difficult to unring that bell after it's happened. So don't assume you're going to be able to get more time. Be prepared for this happening and be prepared with your plans and who's going to say what and who's going to talk to them. Very important going forward.
Excellent point, Chris.
It's like having a fire drill in a sense. Every office has, where's my exits? Who's going where? What's your buddy system? To be organized in that way with FDNS, just to anticipate. You don't know when, you don't know what, but if it happens, mm-hmm. being fully prepared and ready is critical. I think that's very true.
And the other day when we were talking about it as well, I think we were talking about how an employer feels like, oh, I have nothing to hide. I've always complied with the law. Please come in. And they start opening up all their documents and their files. And to Chris's point, once you said certain things that may not be accurate because you didn't slowly and carefully dot your I's and cross your T's, you cannot change what you've already said to them, because then they say, were you lying before or are you lying now? Which one is accurate? So do it right and do it the first time and do it correctly if you need to buy yourself time. The other thing we've heard very often from people is the FDNS officer sometimes will tell the employees, I just need your resume, very harmless question. And then they will look under a microscope at the resume and say, aha, you were marketed with 7 years of experience to the end client, but actually you only had 4 years. So you got this H-1B under fraudulent, as with fraud and misrepresentation. So we're going to request a revocation, because first of all, by law, it's not their business what it is that the employer, the end client wanted. And to Aaron's point, in the subjective element or subjective intent of the client's very happy with the work, everything's going hunky-dory, but now this innocent employee is now giving up what they think is a very innocent, neutral document, which is like to Aaron's example that Aaron always says, you give people a long enough rope to hang themselves. And this is what could end up very well happening. And with respect to the question of what are the timelines to respond to FDNS when they request documentation, as all of us can imagine, all of you as employers, if you've been through this process, we have seen different deadlines over the years, over the last several years that we have been doing this at the Moosey Law Firm, being requested from FDNS officers, which we now potentially believe could very well change now that the new regulation, a regulation since January of 2025, creates new consequences for failure to, within quotes, fully cooperate. And this seems to be driven internally, entirely by internal policies. Sometimes the investigating officers do not provide a timeline, but they keep following up with the employer or the employee or multiple parties to see who is going to respond. We are probably going to tell people to keep the lines of communication with the officer open so they know that you as the employer is absolutely being responsive. Even if you need a little more time to discuss with your HR internal person or your immigration coordinator or with your immigration lawyer, then you were initially given to respond because by law there is no official timeline or deadline, unlike, for example, a request for evidence or a NOID or a notice of intention to revoke, which has the 87 days or 30 days or 15 days to respond for such matters, right? So, Aaron, what happens once the employer and employee respond to the inquiry? What happens next? How do we know that everything has been hopefully resolved?
Well, there's pre-adjudication if they come while an application is still pending or a petition is still pending, and then there's post-adjudication. Pre-adjudication is easy. If the case gets approved, yay, you won. If the case gets denied, whoa, so sorry. Let's read the basis for the denial, and we'll find out how the investigation went. But post-adjudication after a site visit is a little bit more complicated because in post-adjudication after a site visit, you know, it's what's the FDNS officer's caseload? When will they get up to writing the report? How will they submit the report to the officers who do the adjudications, who do the reopening of cases or issue notices of intent to revoke and so on and so forth? So now you're at a timeline that could be months. It could be weeks, it could be years in some cases. You really don't know. It's a waiting game to see what happens and how it develops. So that's something where it becomes a whole different type of situation altogether.
Thank you, Aaron. And, you know, Chris, what do you think? I mean, are these agencies chatting, sharing information? How's all of this panning out?
Oh, absolutely they are. And that's been going on for a long time. That's not new with these regulations. We have a whole bunch of different agencies here. We have FDNS, which is part of USCIS. We have ICE. We have theoretically HSI, Homeland Security Investigations for fraud or criminal charges. There DOL for wage violations. I mean, these agencies talk to each other. We don't really know the extent to which they talk to each other, but we know it happens. So if you have an agency investigating a company doing a site visit, They might find something that's not really related to their particular investigation, but they can still clue in another agency that there might be something that would interest them. And that's absolutely a risk. USCIS has formed a partnership with ICE, in which mostly FDNS pursues administrative inquiries like fraud on petitions or applications. And ICE will have the authority to conduct potential criminal investigations if it's a situation where there's wide scale or systemic fraud with a company or an individual. And also if a company is frequently, constantly, consistently being subjected to site visits, if this is not a one-time occasional thing, if this is happening monthly or four or five times a year, that could well indicate that the company is actually under investigation. This is not a random site visit. So if you are consistently getting multiple site visits, or you're getting multiple site visits a year, you probably want to talk to an attorney to review your files, review your immigration history, to see if there's anything that's problematic in the background of the company or the individuals that's triggering all these inquiries. Because multiple site visits is not random. That usually means that there's some specific targeted investigation going on.
Thank you, Chris. And, you know, as Aaron and Chris have been saying, they have been involved in multitudes over the last 15, 20, 25 years, 20 years plus since FDNS and ICE and all of these agencies were created, really been seeing the ramp up. We saw the huge ramp up, I think, after 2007, 2009, when that whole fraud assessment report came out back, I think, 15 plus years ago, 16 years ago. And so since then, there's been a lot of work. This has been a very active, area where the Muti Law Firm has been very active. Aaron and Chris have been involved, along with other attorneys at the Muti Law Firm, in talking to employers, talking to FDNS agents, negotiating with ICE, negotiating down a lot of the fines and the penalties. A lot of it is, first of all, presenting the case in the best light forward. First of all, getting your ducks in a row, right? Presenting it and then trying hard to negotiate in the best possible manner. And so, you know, I know we try to wrap these up in 30 to 45 minutes, so we're well within, just about within the time. But as an employer, for you to deal with the aftermath of a site visit or an investigation, obviously it's very expensive, it's time-consuming, it's draining. It's mentally, it's demoralizing for you and for your employees and your team, your employer team. But you absolutely want to cooperate. You want to follow the new regulations. We expect and anticipate that the frequency of these kinds of visits and investigations could increase under the current administration, especially for H-1B work at third-party locations. And so, again, to summarize what we kind of all three of us have been saying, that for an employer, the safest and the best course would be to be well prepared before the government knocks on your door, self-audit, review your files. If you don't have the right support to do it, engage a knowledgeable and experienced law firm like the Muti Law Firm to guide you, to help you, to review it, to tell you, hey, these are what you need to do before the government knocks, because when you've done it in advance, it makes you look so much better. Have standard operating procedures or SOPs in place so that to ensure that you're in compliance and that your staff, your team is mentally and physically trained and prepared and ready. Who's going to be responsible for managing which areas of the company's business? And the final point we want to make is feel free, you should. I think Abraham Lincoln said only a fool represents himself, right? You absolutely want to bring in the assistance of experienced, knowledgeable, qualified attorneys, law firm, like the Muti Law Firm, like other firms, if you're confident and comfortable, who have been doing this for years and years and years, to discuss your case, to negotiate, to try to see how we could try to provide the information and present it in the best, most positive light, or minimize any risks, fines, or damages that could impact you, your employer, your business, your company, and your employees. Rather, you know, the earlier, what is like Aaron's point, it's much less expensive to be prepared and to prevent a tragedy from occurring than after the tragedy occurs. So with that, I want, on behalf of myself, Sheila Murthy, on behalf of Aaron Finkelstein, Chris Drynan, and that entire Murthy Law Firm team, we want to thank you for joining us today. Feel free to reach out to us. Good luck as we deal with all of this and all of the ups and downs and the stresses of trying to run your business, make your payroll, pay your taxes, follow the law, and deal with ever-changing regulations. But having a good partner and a friend along life's journey, like the Muti Law Firm, hopefully is one less thing you need to worry about. So thank you very much, and we look forward to continuing to guide and support you along this journey. Have a great rest of the day. Bye now.
This is a free service. The content is the protected, copyrighted property of the Murthy Law Firm. Unauthorized recording or dissemination of these materials without prior permission is prohibited by law. Learn about our firm, how to engage our services, and more at www.murthy.com.